From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, please let me say a sincere thank you. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Well, the dust is settling after an embarrassing, confusing TV show-like midterm election. Embarrassing because in a nation of cutting-edge technology and widespread rhetoric about the sanctity of every vote, archaic voting machines, inept staffing, and predictable but outrageous waiting times again and again, much worse in Democratic precincts, made this central right of democracy unnecessarily difficult and inexcusably uncertain. Confusing because again and again, state officials, sometimes themselves on the ballot, made decisions that only complicated the voting process, and in one case, asked their staff to say, "He won the election." And that's on top of the noise generated by overheated campaign rhetoric from the actual serving president, who jeered and insulted and mocked political opponents day after day, despite a nation grieving an unprecedented anti-Semitic bloodbath and a flood of bombs targeting the biggest names in the Democratic Party. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, notable developments included the vote in Arkansas to alter the state constitution and display the Ten Commandments on public property, as well as to recognize what some refer to as fetal personhood. That's a concept that's been on the ballot in three other states, but never passed until now. That anti-gay Kentucky county clerk has lost her post. Voters tossed intolerance pioneer Kim Davis from office at the same time exit polls showed that white evangelicals, particularly women, continue to be the GOP's most reliable base. Still, a remarkably diverse and women-led slate of candidates seized the House of Representatives and many state-level offices. The number of Muslim women in Congress goes from 0 to 2. The number of Native American women in Congress goes from 0 to 2. And the youngest woman ever elected to Congress is heading to our nation's capital from the Bronx, New York. Racially tinged attacks on two prominent African American gubernatorial candidates may have helped deny them victories. And a young man who found his voice, movingly speaking for his two moms and marriage equality in front of state legislators 7 years ago, won his race. Zach Walls will be one of the youngest Iowa state senators ever. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
Very graciously conceded the election.
God bless Texas!
And we've earned endorsements from people like President Donald J. Trump.
Assalamu alaikum!
No doubt about it, The 2018 election was an exciting time. At the same time, in a reality TV presidency, a lot of us could do with a little less excitement. Still, a look at the vote and at what is likely to come next is in order, and political management expert Greg LaBelle will be with us to provide some insights.
Are the Republicans more godly than the other party? I've looked at it and I said, there's no doubt about it. They're at least not anti-God.
Exit polls show that white evangelicals were almost as reliably midterm Republican voters as they had been Trump voters. At the same time, recent weeks saw the nuns on the bus headed for Mar-a-Lago and progressive pastors quoting scripture in challenging this administration's policies. There's no better observer of these trends than Religion News Service national reporter Jack Jenkins, and he'll be back with us later in the hour. But first,
a very low IQ person, Maxine Waters.
This other guy is a stone cold. In my opinion, he's a thief. How can you have a guy like this?
She's not qualified to be the governor of Georgia. She's not qualified.
The last thing I want to do in 2018 America is discuss racist political campaign tactics. And frankly, it's the last thing I would have expected we'd find ourselves having to do. But here we are. Joining me now is lifelong civil rights activist and longtime president of the San Francisco branch of the NAACP and a dear friend, the Reverend Dr. Amos Brown. Amos, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you for the opportunity of sharing with you again.
A lot of Americans are uncomfortable talking about racism, but we can't hope to start fixing a problem until we identify the problem. So with that in mind, what are the top one or two instances of racist campaigning that stood out for you during the midterm elections?
Actually, prior to the midterm election,
mm-hmm.
the climate was created by the now president of this country, Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And we must stop giving him a pass for being the face and the prime promoter of racist political rhetoric and practices. When he came up with the Bertha proposition that Mr. Obama was not citizens of this nation, the populist crowd that he created supported him all the way. And in addition to that, the faith community, the church, particularly evangelicals, have been complicit that this president, as it has historically, in promoting racist doctrines, practices, and policies. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., my mentor and teacher, said at his entering moment at Crozer Seminary, and I quote him, "The church is supposed to be the most radical opposer of the status quo in society. Yet in many instances, it is the greatest preserver of the status quo. So it was very easy for slavery to receive religious sanction. The church is one of the chief exponents of racial bigotry. Monopoly capitalism has always received the sanction of the church. Since this is the case, we must admit," said Dr. King, "that the church is far from Christ. Mm-hmm. And we have received the data that 70 to 80% of white evangelicals in America support Donald Trump."
Amos, who do you see that is working to improve what's happening in our electoral process?
I see some hope in groups like Sojourner and Jim Wallace.
Mm-hmm.
I see some hope in Derek Johnson, president and chief executive officer of NAACP, our civic engagement program has been on the ground throughout this midterm election, and we are now gearing up for the 2020 election to get the millennials particularly to see that one vote does count. We must exercise not only this right, but this responsibility to be a part of the answer and not a part of the problem. And I contend that if we do not live out the vision of John Winthrop, who from the Arabella back in the 1600s envisioned a city on the hill in which people would live out Michael's word of doing justice, loving mercy, and walking humbly with one's God. If we do not hurry up and make this more of a reality, I predict that this nation will fall as ancient Rome fell. I see too many parallels of how Rome and its leadership were not on the side of justice, inclusion, and equality of opportunity for all. Rome could not even improve its infrastructure. And we're experiencing the same thing in Mississippi alone, my home state. They had to close 500 bridges last year, and about 1,200 are substandard. Potholes are on streets in major communities, San Francisco, New York. So we have not been about measures that go for the making of a civil and beloved society, as we ought to have done. But I hope that through sensible, courageous, compassionate, and creative groups like NAACP, Sojourner, Barbara Skinner Williams with her organization there in Washington, D.C., that we can be the remnant, the conscience, calling the people as prophets and prophetess back to the best angels that should be in all of us.
You know, it's stunning sometimes how quickly people want to forget our profoundly racist recent history. It was 1959 that you, Amos Brown, personally criticized segregated schools in a newspaper interview. You were a high school student at the time, and for expressing your opinion, tell us what happened to you.
I was denied readmittance to Jim Hill High School, where I was an ascending senior, because I spoke about the inequalities in educational opportunities for black children in the state of Mississippi and the disparities in teachers and administrators' salaries. And it was Mega Wiley Evers who threatened to file a suit for the desegregation of Provine High School that they decided that they would let me back in. When he made that threat, I went on to Morehouse, where I finished my baccalaureate degree. But I was just a kid, and even the State Sovereignty Commission, this watchdog, this FBI, on all civil rights workers from 1957 to 1972, had a 10-page file on me. Everywhere I went, to a convention, anywhere I spoke, after I organized the first youth council in NAACP, after Emmett Till was murdered in 1955. Just think about it. The climate was so racist, so unjust, that they spent millions of dollars to spy on and to intimidate civil rights workers. Even Reverend George Washington Lee, a Baptist preacher, president of the Belzoni branch of NAACP, was murdered on May the 7th, 1955. Why? Because he refused to take his name off the voting list in Humphreys County, Mississippi. I feel that America, must come to its senses and deal with this issue of race, this original sin, as Jim Wallace calls it, in which we have really insulted the justice, the love, and the power of God by treating people wrongly because of the color of their skins, because of their religion, because of their class, of their personal lifestyles. We must get rid of this dichotomous thinking of them against us, us against them. We all came from the same habitat, the same home in Africa, according to the paleontologist Leakey. But since we left home and migrated around the earth, wherever we stopped and developed cultures, we created the them against us mentality, and that has led into wars and the loss of many lives because of this age-old sin.
I wanted you to share that personal story because many people are so ready to accuse anyone of playing the race card as if that meant some imaginary racism was being described, when racism has been and continues to be deeply real. Amos, for the generations of Americans who grew up in a desegregated nation, what can we say to help them recognize how real and how powerful the impulse of racism still is today?
There has been a resegregation of public schools in urban communities. A study came out some years ago indicating that we are worse off than we were in 1954 when the Supreme Court decision was handed down. In San Francisco alone, black students are the worst performing ethnic racial group in the state of California. In the midst of all of this high technology, all of the affluence of this city, over 50% of the suspensions in the school district are black children, even though the black population is only now about 4.9%. You look at Juvenile Hall, 75% of the residents there are black juveniles. And we have the lowest achievement in math and science. This reflects a culture of benign neglect when it comes to the treatment of black students. Of course, the family has a responsibility, but the family is not able to be self-sustaining because why? The median income for blacks in the city is $29,000 a year. But for whites, it's $101,000. So as long as we have these kinds of glaring disparities, it will have a ripple effect and cause families to fall apart. Why? Because they do not have the basic necessities of life, like health care, like the opportunity of having enough money to go on a vacation and to relax like others have done. We need to make sure that we are living out the notion of being one nation, under God, indivisible with liberty and justice for all. But right now, it's just a whole lot of symbolism and a whole lot of preachment. But in terms of walking the walk, we have fallen down. And I pray and hope that through your efforts, Rabbi Moline and others, that we will be that continuous conscience, calling our people, calling our nation, back to being expressions of our better angels and not demonic and evil that is rampant in this country today.
The Reverend Dr. Amos Brown is a lifelong civil rights activist, the longtime president of the San Francisco NAACP, and pastor of the Third Baptist Church there. Amos, thank you so much for taking time out of a very busy schedule today to be with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, and thank you for all the good work that you continue to do.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. We'll dig into the significance of the election results with political management expert Greg LaBelle and later Religion News Service national reporter Jack Jenkins about the faith-based voices coming to the fore in both electoral and cultural politics in our country. I'm Welton Getty. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. For many years, I've been grateful to be able to turn to political management expert Greg LaBelle, the veteran of several presidential campaigns. Today, clarity is needed more than ever. That's why it's great news that we can look at this midterm election and its results together. Greg, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton.
Some critical races remain unresolved, but what were your overall impressions of what happened on Tuesday?
Other than some individual disappointments in races, and I think of the governorships of Florida and Georgia in particular, although I think who knows how the Georgia situation is going to end up, I think that Democrats should be relatively pleased. The House flipped, which was the main focus, I think, of everything. I think the Senate did what we originally thought the Senate was going to do. I think everyone knew that this was going to be a very difficult year for Democrats in the Senate just because of the seats that were up for election and reelection. And I think that Democrats should look at this 35-some-odd seats that they've picked up in the House, 7 governorships, 6 statewide chambers, and I think in some ways one of the most important numbers, over 225 state legislative seats across the country. This is good stuff, and I think we need to acknowledge that and think about what that means for the future.
Did some races stand out for you as the results came in?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the ways in which some of the races stood out was that we still don't seem to have polling figured out. I mean, we saw this 2 years ago in the presidential election. I think the polling numbers were a little bit better this year in their estimation of the final results. But I think that we saw some races that looked like they were going to be closer. And again, I think Florida and Georgia are two that stand out for me, both the Florida Senate and gubernatorial race and obviously the Georgia gubernatorial race. Mm-hmm. And I think, there may be two reasons for that, for pollsters, one of which is I think in this new era, and again, we saw this 2 years ago, we haven't quite figured out, I think, how to identify who the likely voters are. That could be part of the problem. And the other part of the problem is I think that there are folks who are not telling pollsters the truth. We did see this in the presidential election, and we may continue to see it. So we have to be careful, I think, how we look at the numbers. I think that there were some exciting races. Colorado elected the first openly gay man as a governor, which is a breakthrough. I think that it's important to note that 2 Native Americans women were elected to the House of Representatives, and not much has been made of this, but an old friend of mine, a Native American woman, was elected Lieutenant Governor of Minnesota. 2 Muslim women will be in the House. The Democratic Party is clearly the party on the cusp of the change that this country is going through, and the Republican Party is not. That's an important aspect, I think, for us all to keep in mind as we move forward.
As you look at the system generally, was it less shaky or more shaky than you expected?
I don't think it was more than I expected. I think what happens in these races, and I think, a lot of talk about a blue wave and so on and so forth, I think Democrats got a little carried away with what a blue wave might actually entail. We didn't see that quite across the board, but I think it's hard to argue against an important wave moving through the House of Representatives. I don't think that this, in that respect, was any different from most other midterm elections that we've seen.
Mm-hmm. Greg, I have heard almost nothing about the potential foreign invasions of the voting network. Is that a good sign, or is it just proof of how distractible our news media has become?
It is, I think, reflective of how our news media continues, I think, to chase after, shiny objects. I think it is indicative of how good this president is at producing shiny objects at appropriate times. And he's very, very good at that. He always has been. And I think it's also indicative of the fact that we probably won't hear anything about foreign invasions from the South much anymore, because this was a part of the fear campaign that the White House was running. And there's really no need for it anymore. So I think a lot of things that the president was talking about and waving in front of people's faces will probably not be talked about very much from the White House from here on out.
Greg, as you see it, what forces were the most influential in determining what happened at the ballot box?
That's an interesting and complex question from my perspective on the negative side. We saw once again that the politics of anger and fear work. We saw a president who was more willing than any president, certainly in my lifetime, to use those in ways that I have never seen and frankly hope I never see again, but proof that the politics of fear can be a very effective short-term means of accomplishing electoral goals. And I think that's just the reality. I think the other thing that I find particularly interesting is how demographics in this country are shifting. I think that what we see happening is really quite dramatic in many ways, and I'm not sure we've quite figured out how to measure it. I was telling somebody the other day that when I was first involved in politics, 30 or 40 years ago, whatever it was now, one of the things that we knew is that the older cohorts tended to vote Democratic because these were folks who were part of the old FDR coalition. At the time, it was sort of a given that people who were better educated and therefore made a little more money tended very much to vote Republicans. We've seen those two change dramatically, and this election proved it once again. The older one gets in a cohort now, the more likely we see that they are to support President Trump, and we have seen that increase in education is moving people toward Democrats, certainly since Trump has been president. And I think we add to that the real significant issue of the suburbs, which again tended to be Republican strongholds in the days of Republicans like Bob Dole and so forth. And the suburbs have moved in dramatic ways in this election toward Democrats. And again, this is mostly about Trump. And so one could say, well, then when Trump is out of office, everything goes back to normal. But I'm not sure that that's true because there is no more Republican Party as we knew it just a few years ago. This is the Trump Party now. And we have watched almost every Republican get on board with this politics of fear and anger. And it's disturbing in that sense, but I'm not sure that it means that we can go back to where we were before this.
The Parkland students, these young activists worked tirelessly to raise awareness and get out the youth vote. Do you think it paid off, and will that kind of organizing continue, do you think?
I think it has to continue. I think that's part of the key. I think that we have to keep going. We do know that a large number of NRA-backed candidates lost on Tuesday, which tells us something. I haven't seen the final numbers with regard to the youngest cohort's voting turnout, but my understanding is that they were up. I hope that that's the case. But again, this is something that I think people who care about keeping young people engaged can't just sort of sit back and wait until we're in the height of primary season for the presidential in 2 years. This kind of organizing has to continue, and that's hard because people lose interest. They get bored. They get tired of it. They want a rest. But it's important to find ways to keep that organizing alive and moving along in the interim between these elections, and I think that will be an important key to what happens the next time around.
Does it concern you that long lines to vote were talked about like they were a sign of patriotism as opposed to a failure of voting officials to properly plan for the kind of turnout all of us saw coming?
Oh, yes. I mean, the long lines are only a part of this. I mean, there are serious questions being raised in a number of states about voter suppression, and I'm amazed, frankly, at the willingness of some of these officials to be so bald-faced about voter suppression. A Georgia classic example, 53,000 potential voters being held in suspense for some ridiculous aspect of the law that required exact matches on voting cards and Social Security numbers and so on and so forth. I mean, this is unheard of. And added to that is the fact that the person who was holding this was the Secretary of State, who was the Republican candidate for governor. North Dakota, the decision to disenfranchise Native Americans because they didn't have street addresses. Native Americans who live in large parts of North Dakota don't have street addresses. They have RFDs, and they were denied the right to vote. And this was actually held up in one of the courts. This is the kind of voter suppression I think that we have to be very, very concerned about. And it carries right through to voting machines that aren't working, closing of voting places. This happened all over a couple of states, certainly in Georgia and other states, where people were effectively denied the right to vote by official act of closing voting places, minimizing the number of voting stations that are available, and then outright just denying people their constitutional right to vote. Yeah, this is a serious issue. And I don't think it's going to go away quickly. I think there are enough people who are alarmed by this now that this will continue to be a topic of conversation and discussion and try to figure out what to do about it.
Something like 12 million more votes were cast for Democrats than for Republicans in the 2018 Senate races, and yet the GOP gained seats. How does that math work?
Same thing happened 2 years ago. This is the old term that we've heard from when we were in middle school. This is gerrymandering. This is the process by which these lines are drawn. And these lines are drawn at the state level by state legislatures and governors. And a couple of them have been called out, Pennsylvania being one of them, where the court said, no, you can't do this. I think North Carolina's and Texas were also ran into some trouble with the courts on these things. But this is where lines are drawn very carefully on a partisan basis, particularly when one party controls both houses of their state legislatures and the governorship, and that has been primarily Republicans in the past few cycles, not always, but in the last few cycles, the result of which is that lines are drawn so that they minimize the importance of the votes of the opposite party. And this is exactly what, as I said, this is what happened 2 years ago. It was at least as significant this time. I was happy to see that three states, I think Minnesota, Colorado, I forget the third one, actually voted to take the drawing of these lines out of the hands of the legislatures and put them in the hands of independent commissions, which is, I think, the best solution we can come up with to stopping this. But that's exactly why this is happening. This is why many, many more people can vote this time for Democratic Party, and Republicans come out winning more seats.
The president tweeted an overt threat to the new Democratic House majority, preemptively trying to inoculate his administration against investigations. And then he appointed an anti-Mueller pundit to head up the Justice Department.
This president is scared. It's quite clear to me, having watched most of his press conference on the day after the election, this president is now scared. He has had the luxury for 2 years of a House and Senate that were not only controlled by his party, but controlled by what I can only call sycophants who were willing, at the cost of, I think, their own credibility in so many occasions, to sit back and let him do whatever he wanted to do. And that has now changed, despite the fact that he declared the elections on Tuesday to be a near-perfect victory, I think, was close to what he called it anyway, completely ignoring the fact that the House of Representatives is now in the hands of Democrats and Nancy Pelosi, who really knows how to get things done. He's frightened. He knows things are going to change, but I don't think he begins to understand how they're going to change. So he's doing what he has always done. He's lashing out. He's threatening. And the kinds of threats that we heard on Wednesday were exactly what we will hear more of. I think that we are about to see a Donald Trump that far surpasses anything we've seen so far in terms of outrageous behavior.
Until his retirement, Greg LaBelle taught political management at George Washington University in Washington, D.C., where he continues to lead the semester abroad program. Greg has held leadership positions at Interfaith Alliance and has worked inside several presidential campaigns. All of that adds up to the kind of expertise we so badly need to make even a little sense of what we see happening in our government and politics today. Thank you for being with us again today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton. It's always a joy to talk with you.
Jack Jenkins is the award-winning national writer for Religion News Service and a keen observer of the religio-political landscape in our nation. At this critical time, I am particularly grateful to be able to call on his expertise. And so, Jack, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
Did you see religious rhetoric play a significant role in the campaigns this time?
So there was certainly religious rhetoric that came out of the supporters of various candidates. I mean, I think one of the things that was interesting about tracking this election season is, per usual, the religious right sent out their supporters to do, to back Republican candidates. That's not unusual, nor is it particularly interesting. In the sense of that it wasn't newsworthy. I mean, it isn't news-breaking. But the religious left also showed up in a big way and were pushing their candidates that supported the issues that they cared about, which were things like, raising the minimum wage, ending gun violence, those sorts of things, and particularly targeting marginalized communities such as African Americans and Hispanic Americans, through their congregations and their churches, to turn out on election day and to take care to whoever they voted for to support, specific kinds of policies that tend to skew left. And you saw a much bigger turnout, a much bigger mobilization effort, at least, among those demographics. So I think that was certainly evident in the lead up to election day. Now, there was also some, religious rhetoric the day of. I mean, one thing that a lot of people have talked about is the election of now three Muslim Americans in the U.S. House of Representatives, two Muslim women who were also the first of their kind to win a seat at the U.S. House of Representatives, one on Tuesday night. And then Representative Andre Carson also won re-election and thus was able to, now we have three different Muslim representatives of Congress. But the other reference to religious rhetoric on election night actually came from Tim Kaine, who, while in his victory speech, and he won, which was not unexpected, in the state of Virginia, the senator referenced the Hindu holiday of Diwali, which is a festival of light. And he said, quote, Diwali is a celebration of good over evil, that is happening this week, the celebration of light over darkness, the celebration of understanding over ignorance. That's what today is. That's what we're starting today. Now, Tim Kaine is not Hindu. He is Catholic. But it certainly seems to be a fluency in religious rhetoric that we don't often see on election night speeches.
Oh, yeah. The two Muslim women who are going to be ascending to Congress, was their faith an issue in the campaign, or did their opponents not stoop that low this year?
I think where they ran, in particular in Michigan and Minnesota, there's been some comfort level with Muslim candidates and Muslim Americans in general that you won't find necessarily in other places. So, for instance, one of the women actually filled the seat vacated by Keith Ellison, who was the first Muslim American elected to Congress, who actually vacated that seat earlier this year so he could run for attorney general. And actually, he also won that evening as well. So those places are actually, on a relative scale, less hostile to Muslim candidates. Now, what you did see throughout this election season and what there was some reporting around is actually an uptick in anti-Islam rhetoric among particularly Republican candidates. And that has been tried before by Republicans, and it often doesn't work very well in elections. It is statistically, it often doesn't necessarily lead to a path to victory for those who invoke it during the campaign. It can have a backlash effect. But I think a lot of people saw Donald Trump's election, particularly when he invoked what was at the time an explicit Muslim ban, a ban on Muslims entering the country during his 2016 bid for the presidency, and thought, well, if I replicate that, perhaps I could also give an unexpected victory. But it wasn't a big night for candidate to invoke anti-Islam rhetoric, and instead it was a big night for Muslims who were elected to Congress. So if anything, the trends seem to skew a little bit in the other way, even if the rhetoric itself the anti-Islam rhetoric itself is spiking.
How about the role of religion-infused awareness raising and get-out-the-vote efforts?
So those were robust this year. As mentioned, the religious left efforts in particular, you saw people like Faith in Public Life and Faith in Action, which is a both of which are mobilization efforts and political groups that have congregations and congregation networks whose activism often skews left. And they were particularly present in the states of Florida and Georgia. Now, the thing to remember there is Democrats, you know, were in some ways disappointed by the results in Florida and Georgia because they were hoping for victories in the gubernatorial races there and the Senate races in those states. But the truth is, it's actually really interesting that it was as close as it is. I mean, we're actually staring at the potential of recounts in both of those states. And, you know, getting to those margins may have had a lot to do with these faith-based groups that targeted, again, Hispanic-American communities in parts of Florida and African-American communities in Georgia, including rural African-American communities that were, struggling with voting issues. You know, we had people like the Reverend William Barber II actually show up to those locations and, you know, hold what they were calling revivals or prayer rallies to advocate for those groups to show up in as large numbers as possible to support candidates that, quite frankly, often skewed towards the Democratic spectrum. So in that, in addition to that, you had groups like Vote Common Good, which was a effort put forward by, for lack of a better term, progressive evangelicals, often those who feel disaffected by the religious right but still claim an evangelical identity, that went on a bus tour of districts across the country to try to appeal to this demographic. And actually, on Election Day this year, white evangelical Protestants still supported Republicans in overwhelming numbers. You saw roughly 75% still back Republicans. But that is technically down if you compare that to the support that Donald Trump enjoyed on Election Day in 2016, where he got 80 to 81% of white evangelicals supporting him. This percentage, that 75% number, is actually more in line with what you see in, like, midterm elections in the past. So it's anyone's guess if that, you know, was a product of these sort of mobilization efforts, but there definitely seems to be a little bit of shifting in various religious sectors. And I'll just close by noting that the Catholics weren't broken down by race this go-around in exit polling. It's just Catholics as a whole. Mm-hmm. But they technically flipped as well compared to 2016 and 2014. Catholics collectively voted slightly more, 50%, for Democrats, as opposed to Republicans. And that's the reverse of how it was in previous elections. So I think those mobilization efforts by these different progressive faith groups certainly seem to have an effect, particularly in targeted races. It's also true that Jewish Americans seem to view more towards Democrats this go-round than they have in years past. You actually have to go back to the early 2000s to find an election cycle, either presidential or midterm, in which they voted in the same percentages of support for Democrats as they did this go-around, you know, into the high 70s, early 80s for that sort of thing. So when we transfer that back to, you know, 2018, you know, obviously that happened in the wake of the tragic synagogue shooting in Pittsburgh very recently, and a rise and spike in anti-Semitic rhetoric across the country. So it's also interesting to note if those demographics in certain targeted districts also could play a significant role here moving forward in the aftermath of that. But in terms of specific policy breakdowns, we're still waiting to hear more from the exit polling experts. Hopefully we're going to get more data, as I think most religion journalists would attest. My kingdom for more religion data election. But as soon as I find out, I'll let y'all know.
Where else do you expect to see the religious left claim its place in our public discourse? And is that likely to be a good thing?
So I think the religious left is having a moment in a big way. I think one of the things that we're seeing in this election, in terms of their mobilization efforts, in terms of their the rise of their rock stars like William Barber II and Tracy Blackman, et cetera, one of the things that we're seeing in that is this increased, enhanced presence of the religious left. I mean, you had the other day an instance on CNN where a CNN anchor actually pitted the rhetoric of William Barber II against the rhetoric of the head of the Family Research Council, a classic religious right figure, Tony Perkins. And that kind of dialogue is actually relatively new in our discourse. And so, you know, and meanwhile, you have potential presidential candidates like Senator Cory Booker who actually speaks about religion quite regularly on the stump. In fact, the only other time I've heard anyone invoke, I mean, Cory Booker is attends a Baptist church. The only other time I've heard anyone invoke Hindu faith from in any sort of interview is actually he recently, outside of Tim Kaine, referred to the Hindu god Shiva to help describe the current political moment that we're in, Shiva being this god of destruction. So, you know, you actually have a lot more faith fluency among Democrats these days than you have in years past. And so I think it'll be interesting to watch to see if they try to double down on that kind of rhetoric while also balancing the fact that there are many Democrats who are uncomfortable with politicians talking about faith. But at the end of the day, you know, I say this a lot, you look at that Alabama Senate race last year when and the unexpected victory of Doug Jones over Roy Moore. And you see that the big turnout and difference that helped elevate Doug Jones to the Senate was the presence of black voters, particularly African-American women in that state. And a lot of the mobilization around those groups happened in churches. Yeah. So I think that there's a strong chance in the next election cycle we're going to see more efforts to, you know, really kind of speak to minority groups and their faith traditions so the Democrats can try to run up the score.
We're looking at a deeply divided nation, split along geographic and ideological and religious lines. Do you see anything to suggest that the polarization won't simply continue to get worse?
That is a big question. The short answer is, I would say yes and no. So I think there, part of the elements of polarization, the factors that are leading to it, don't seem to be getting better. I mean, it wouldn't be a stretch to say that the rhetoric coming out of the Trump administration, regardless of how they intend it or how they structure it, it just has a polarizing effect on the U.S. electorate. It has frustrated liberals and even many conservatives and pushed people into camps that are really, really frustrated and angry at one another. And it has, many have argued that it has emboldened extremists, where you have white supremacists and others who feel emboldened by the president and his rhetoric, regardless of whether or not he intends that to be the case. Those are some really disturbing trends. And if you cover the religion like I do, you actually see it a lot, because these groups often come in contact with the faith communities I cover, and usually not in a good way.
Yeah.
That having been said, I will say that there does seem to be lingering moments of exhaustion with that kind of polarization, that there is start to be this push towards not only a rejection of that sort of volatile rhetoric, but also an embrace of something more, of saying not necessarily uniform truth and reconciliation forgiveness across the board, but that faith communities would, you know, while they want to be the first people in line to protest against things they feel are unjust, they are also starting to talk about ways to reach across and talk to, you know, if you're a Christian or brother and sister of Christ, or if you're of another faith tradition or of no faith tradition, a way to find some sort of common ground, common good. Again, this is only on the edges. I do not believe that this is the main narrative or the main feeling about throughout this country. But I do think there are some who are starting to get tired of being so angry all the time. And while that anger, the policies that anger them don't seem to be going away, they do want to figure out a way to bring other people into alignment so that, you know, we can move the country in a different direction. So that's a long-winded way of saying, I think some folks are going to be really interested in persuasion and not just protesting pretty soon.
Jack Jenkins is the national reporter at Religion News Service, a nonpartisan, non-denominational resource for all of us who recognize the profound impact faith and spirituality have on the world around us. Jack, I really want to thank you for taking time to be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Well, I'm always grateful to come on. Thank you so much.
Now, before we go, it can be no surprise that just since the election, the chaos and the violence that have enveloped our nation continue unabated. A college night at a California country music bar ended with yet another mass shooting. Perhaps almost as frightening as the death toll is the numbness to such stories that seems to be descending on Americans. It's an understandable defense mechanism, and can, I suppose, serve to distance one from such mayhem until it happens to one of your children, our grandchildren, or until it happens to you. The chaos in our government continues unabated as well, with the departure of Attorney General Jeff Sessions. The investigation into foreign invasion of our electoral system is in serious jeopardy. And that's what the investigation is about. Regardless of the partisan rhetoric surrounding it, our republic, if we can keep it, can outlast this presidency and this century, but foreign control of our votes cannot be allowed. That's what Robert Mueller is investigating. That's what he is tasked with protecting. Jeff Sessions, well-qualified deputy, was leapfrogged by a far-right pundit who has been bloviating for many months about the need to and ways for the president to shut down the Mueller investigation. How on earth is this the best qualified candidate for this critically important position? Or perhaps I've just answered my own question. Still, it was inspiring to see protests in cities across the nation challenging this crass and self-serving act. At the same time, make no mistake, authoritarian regimes around the world are watching every act of this manufactured drama, learning powerful lessons, and at the same time arguing against democracy to citizens who used to see the United States as the shining city on the hill. Big picture, I'm afraid we are in for a contentious 2 years. The president is masterful at galvanizing his base in the face of threats, real or imagined. And we have seen how galvanizing the base seems to take precedence over absolutely everything else. I'm also afraid our national media has been far from impressive in rising to the unprecedented challenges of this moment. And the challenges are breathtaking. Challenges most American journalists probably never considered possible when they were choosing their profession. Just look at the shocking scenes of newsman Jim Acosta asking the President of the United States a perfectly reasonable question as a White House staffer, her salary paid with your tax dollars, repeatedly attempts to wrest the microphone from his hand and silence him. It's chilling to see, as is the president's subsequent statement, "You are a rude, terrible person. You shouldn't be working for CNN. And then, like clockwork, revoking the press credentials of a leading member of the White House press corps. And this just after the president angrily labeled a question asked by a respected PBS reporter racist. A reporter, by the way, who is herself a racial minority. So, yes, for journalists doing their job properly is going to take patience, courage, and immense integrity. But there is a reason Edmund Burke called the press the fourth estate. We need facts. We need truth. And we need perspective. Regardless of the outcome, I think the actual process of this week's voting went better than we could have reasonably expected in most parts of the country. So we have done our part. Now it's up to the leaders we elected and critically up to the professionals of the press corps to execute, analyze, and keep us informed of the workings of our long-suffering democracy. Meanwhile, this weekend marks the 80th anniversary of Kristallnacht, the night of the broken glass, November 9 through 10, 1938, when mobs in Nazi Germany and Austria rioted and attacked their Jewish neighbors. 267 synagogues were destroyed, as were 7,000 Jewish-owned businesses and countless homes. Law enforcement looked on but did not intervene. Notably, the violence was widely covered by the world press. Nobody could reasonably claim that they didn't know what was happening. One might think such anarchy could have served as a warning. Sadly, history shows it didn't do that. And the subsequent so-called final solution and the genocide of the Holocaust left us with but one simple but profound pledge, as important today as it has ever been: never again. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your generous support of this program helps keep this show on the air week after week. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, thank you, thank you, thank you, on behalf of every one of our listeners. If you think there's value in what you've heard here, please make your contribution today. Please put us on your list for Giving Tuesday, coming up on November 27th. And keep us in mind as you plan your tax-deducted donations at the end of the year. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.